Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Alan First, whose latest novel is Midnight in Europe. Earlier novels, Mission to Paris, Spies of the Balkans, Spies of Warsaw, Night Soldiers. There are 13 espionage novels set in and around the start of World War II. This particular novel, Midnight in Europe, the Spanish Civil War sort of forms a backdrop. It's kind of receded into history. I know that when you and I were growing up, it was a big deal, the precursor to World War II. But now World War II is receding into history. And, of course, it's the 100th anniversary now of World War I. So Spanish Civil War, give a brief outline. What exactly was it in Midnight in Europe? You give some details, but go back. Okay, so Spain was a republic.
Spain was a republic in the period of time 1932 onwards. Hundreds of strikes, hundreds of political assassinations, hundreds of murders, hundreds of buildings being burned down, marches, government taken over, taken back over, by the left, the right, then the left, and the right, then part of the left, and part of the right, and then the left fought each other. It was a kind of chaos. The Spaniards of the 1930s were unable to govern. Not that they were inadequate, they were just unable to govern. There was too much pulling and pushing. Finally, in 1936, with the support of Adolf Hitler, Francisco Franco, General Franco, launched a coup d'etat with the fellow fascist generals. The army went half and half. A lot of the army went over to Franco. A lot of the army didn't. And the government armed the labor unions. They armed the anarchist labor union. This was a real mistake because the anarchist labor union included a lot of criminals and a lot of sort of theoretical Bakuninites and what have you. And they started murdering priests and nuns and burning down churches. And they've never claimed they didn't do it. They dug up priests and nuns from the cemeteries, danced in the streets with the skeletons. The effect this had was that, for one thing, it utterly disabled any will by Franklin Delano Roosevelt to help the Republic, which he wanted to do. But his political base was the Catholic working class in the cities of America. They were never going to accept helping a country where such things went on. It just was out of the question. France and Great Britain were reluctant, more than reluctant, to help. They didn't want the war to start yet. They weren't armed yet. They knew that the war would start, but they were afraid of Hitler starting earlier than he intended, long before they were prepared.
Why were they convinced Hitler would start? And then the other side of it is, if they knew Hitler was going to start, what was appeasement about?
Time, really. The French in 1938-39 sent a purchasing commission to New York to buy airplanes. They were represented by Couder Brothers, quite a good, liberal, fabulous law firm.
And that's in your book, yeah.
Yeah, and that's in the book. The French said, we want to buy 5,000 fighter planes. And it was explained to them that there weren't 5,000 fighter planes to buy. You have to realize that the men who owned the companies that manufactured airplanes, Boeing, etc., had built the first planes with their own hands. This was a young industry. It was only just getting off the ground at that time. The French didn't get their 5,000 planes, and they lost.
So pretty much appeasement was just going to try to put it off a little bit longer, and even Chamberlain knew that.
I really believe Chamberlain believed Hitler when Hitler said, this is the end, I don't want anything more, I simply want the Sudeten Germans protected from the brutal policies of the Czech government.
But all of the characters in all of your novels that take place prior to the war, they all go, well, you know, we know Hitler's going to come. And in fact, your main character, Farrar, in Midnight in Europe, says over and over, he's going to bomb Paris. As it turned out, he didn't. But everyone expected this 2 years before the war.
Yes, because they bombed cities in Spain. No city had ever been bombed before. I mean, they'd been shelled, but never bombed from airplanes and strafed from airplanes. And civilians had never been bombed. Yes, you know, they'd been hit by artillery during sieges forever. But this was very, very different. Planes were faster. When Barcelona was bombed, the Republic had no fighter planes to stop them. They flew 200 feet over the city, bombed for like 8 or 9 days.
How badly was Barcelona destroyed at the time?
It was badly damaged, and thousands of people were killed. But, you know, the Western military attachés and the journalists who were there saw this, and they saw what the effect was. And they saw the helplessness of large populations and what happens. And they believed, and the Brits believed, and this is the subject of my book in part, Dark Star, they believed the bomber always gets through, can't stop it. And there's a scene in Night Soldiers where Lvov is bombed, and it isn't destroyed, and all the people aren't killed. The Brits estimated 50,000 people would die in every bombing raid. So if they bombed every night, they would remove the population of London within a certain number of nights. That's what they believed. They looked at bombers and bombing much as we look at nuclear bombs now. And those will take out a city, as we were later to learn.
Well, Alan, first, you hadn't tackled Spain. Had you always intended on setting a book in and among the Spanish Civil War?
The Spanish Civil War figures in 5 or 6 of my books. It has to, never directly, although there are some scenes in Spain in Night Soldiers. I felt that there had to be. But I put it off. I was doing other things. And for some reason, when it came time for me to do a lawyer book, I decided that the hero would be a lawyer. In fact, this book at one time had a working title of The Spanish Lawyer.
Why did you decide to do a lawyer book?
Because I had done all the other prominent professions of the period. And my books turn on the central character's profession. In other words, I've had 2 foreign correspondents, a movie producer, a prominent film actor, a policeman, a sea captain. These were the people who were prominent during the 30s and in the conflicts of the 30s. I had never done a lawyer. It was definitely time to do a lawyer.
And the moment you decided a lawyer, you knew it would be from that French firm?
No. A friend of mine who knew something about law firms in the period suggested that to me.
Are the other characters from the firm real people?
I never write about real people. I mention their existence, and I might quote them, but you never see Hitler in my books, or Mussolini. You see a picture of him. You see them in newspapers. You see the Hitler in newsreels, screaming and yelling and threatening, but they're not characters in the book.
And none of the lawyers are characters?
No, but they're mentioned also, because they were a terrific group of people. They worked so hard for international justice in all kinds of ways. Now, make no mistake, they were a corporate law firm with wealthy clients and everything else, but they had very serious ethical commitments.
Even though there were a lot of communists fighting on the side of the Republic, and certainly when we hear about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, we think about these great leftists. Stalin, on the other hand,
Stalin didn't want the Republic to win. He wanted the war to continue. What he did was a kind of slow drip of armaments, but a lot of Soviet arms moved into Spain. A lot. They had fighter pilots flying Stormovic fighter planes. They gave the Republic a certain amount of equipment because he wanted to hurt Germany and Italy and, you know, have world opinion on his side. He didn't actually want to give them all that many weapons, and he refused to resupply them. He didn't want Germany to win the Spanish Civil War all that quickly. He wanted it to go on and on, a kind of slow bleed, which, you know, is what happens in proxy wars. It's not, you don't fight them necessarily to win them. You fight them to hurt the sponsors on the other side.
And at that particular time, of course, he needed to try to find a way to create armaments because he knew what was coming.
Absolutely. He couldn't give everything away to the Spanish Republic and leave himself with nothing. He really didn't believe Hitler would attack him. And when Hitler attacked, he went silent for 3 days. He thought they were going to kill him.
1940, you know, he signed the peace pact, which shocked everybody and turned a lot of American communists off to Russia.
Forever.
Forever, yeah.
Absolutely. He had his own political reasons for doing that. He tried hard to make deals with the UK and with France, but the UK and France couldn't make deals with a communist. That was costly because Hitler didn't care, and Stalin went, I got to make a deal here as Europe lines up for the fight. If the British and the French find me so distasteful that they won't make a deal with me, a political raison d'etat kind of deal, well, then I'll make a deal with Hitler. And he proceeded to do that very thing, to the great shock of everybody. Well, then he went and invaded Poland on the 17th. Of September, after Germany invaded on the 1st. A lot of people don't know that Poland was invaded by the Soviet Union. And what they did to the Poles was just as bad as what the Germans did.
Alan, first, this is a little far afield, but at what point did Hitler suddenly say, okay, now I'm going to attack Stalin, and how did that happen? So Stalin went into his three-day funk.
Hitler believed that ultimately, the United States would attack him, and he felt that in order to fight against the Brits and the Americans, he would have to defeat Russia on his other flank, and he believed he could do that. His famous quote is, just give it a good kick and the whole thing will come crashing down, as it did for a time. He set up Operation Barbarossa, which I believe was 1.5 million troops. They lined up on the border of Poland. They lined up on the border in Poland, that's to say. Between the two Polands. And they converted all the hospitals into military hospitals. You can't invade another country and not have them know something's going on. But maybe he said, oh, it's war games, you know, which is what Putin says now about the Ukraine, et cetera, and so forth. And invaded on, I believe, June 21st, 1941.
A few questions about some of the occurrences that happened in midnight in Europe. Officina Tecnico. In Paris. What exactly was that?
It was the Spanish Republic's arms buying office.
Was it secret?
It was not secret, but it was opaque. That's why they call it the Technical Bureau. They didn't call it the Arms Buying Bureau. But everybody who wanted to know about it knew about it. You can't keep it a secret when you're doing a volume of business with a lot of different people in this never-ending search for arms. And spending huge amounts of money.
Were there people inside the Officina Tecnica and inside the embassy who were Franco supporters?
There were probably some people in the embassy who were Franco supporters. I think there might have been in the Officina Tecnica criminals, you know, out for their own gain more than Franco supporters.
There's a scene in Odessa in which the gangs seem to be operating much as Russian gangs operate today, or we think they do based on Hollywood films. Stalin didn't have control over the gangland life of the southern Ukraine, Crimea?
No, I don't think so. If you read the Isaac Babel and the stories of Benya Krik and the Moldavanka neighborhood, the Jewish neighborhood in Odessa, where the gangsters mostly came from. But I mean, you know, they had to be really careful, but they did persist. And they were tough guys, and there were lots of them because people in Russia didn't have enough to eat, they didn't have enough to wear, and eventually when you do that long enough, there are people who will rebel or find a way to rebel against the system and take what they need.
There's also the idea that in a place like Russia, which was, or USSR, which was so centrally focused on Moscow, the further you get away from Moscow, the looser, on some level, things get.
Yes, that's absolutely true. That's always been said.
You're listening to an interview with Alan First, whose latest novel is Midnight in Europe. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. So you have this idea, you know, you have this character, Farrar, and you know he's going to be involved with arms. How do you create a plot, or in this case, a series of interweaving plots? How does that come about? Do you just sit there and start writing? Do you, as you once said, just take a dartboard and a map of Europe and start throwing? How do you proceed from that to a full book?
I first of all find out what actually happened. And there are a lot of books about what actually happened. They don't all agree, but in general they agree. And then once I know that, then I have my plot. Simply, I don't write plots because they sound like plots. What I do is I let history write the plots.
Well, then let's talk about one of them. There's a sequence of trying to get arms out of Poland, for instance. Did people actually try to get arms out of Poland and Gdansk?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There were several organizations, some criminal organizations operating in Poland that stole a lot of money from the Spanish arms buying office. There were other organizations who were, you know, secretly working or were paid off by Franco who sold the Spanish Republic deficient weapons. There was a certain kind of hand grenade that they had. I forget quite the way the expression went, but it was equally likely to kill the enemy as the person who threw it.
Spies in Paris. If you read all of your books, and I've read virtually all of the 13 novels, it seems that Paris was the center of spydom. Is that because Paris is the center of Alan First's books, or because it was the center of spydom?
It was the center of Europe. And as the center of Europe, where the most important people would often find themselves, a lot of Europe revolved around Paris as the central city of Europe, the capital of Europe, if you like, at that time. So naturally, clandestine services were interested in what went on there, and that means you get secret agents or whatever else.
You mentioned many restaurants. The most famous restaurant from your books is Bistro Heinegger, which is Beaufinger, which is right off Bastille, which is still there, and I was actually there. Is there really a mirror with a bullet?
No mirror, no bullet hole. And I have to say Beaufinger isn't as good as it once was. It now belongs to the Brasserie Flow group. I've eaten there a couple times, and it's not very good anymore. Restaurants in Paris have declined. Used to be you could not get a bad meal there. That's no longer true.
Alan First, the other restaurants that you described, were those real?
With everything in my book, some of it's fictional, some of it's real, I try to do it in such a way that people know that. They can figure out what's real and what isn't. For example, Angelina's Tea Room. And Angelina's Tea Room is famous in Paris. Everybody goes there for cocoa and for these pastries. I think a lot of people know it. And when I talk about it, it's pretty clear that it exists. There's another restaurant which only has 12 tables. That really doesn't exist, except that it's a metaphor for all the 12-table restaurants in Paris. Mayor this or Shay that. Somehow I'm able to signal to the reader, you know, that this is a kind of symbolic place rather than a real restaurant.
There's a scene that takes place in Berlin, and there's a nightclub scene there.
And it's a real nightclub.
That's a real
or
nightclub.
Or was a real nightclub.
Okay. It seemed that even in 1938, there were still vestiges of the wild Berlin of the 20s that we all know about.
Vestiges, yes. But once the Nazis came in, that was the end. I mean, they arrested homosexuals, they suppressed dancing and music by African Americans. They were against what they called decadent culture. That's why they burned books. That's why they burned some paintings and stole others. That was just their program. They were going to purify the population.
There's a novel called Fatherland, which is a science fiction novel, which kind of assumes Hitler won.
Right. And is that the Robert? I think it's the Robert Harris.
Yeah. The architecture they used Spears architecture, which was just massive. And there must have been a little bit of that. And none of it, of course, survived the war. But some of it had been built, right?
A lot of it had been built. Over in that neighborhood on the edge of the park, they built Gestapo headquarters and everything else. And they were these massive concrete buildings. Hitler had pretensions to being an architect, and he liked Speer and built quite a few of the buildings that Speer designed.
There's this strange 10-year-old Berlin that came and went in history.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I think the Reichstag survived to some degree. The rest of it was just knocked to pieces.
Alan, first, I'd like to go back and talk a little about your early career, because you began a little bit late in the game writing these books. There were four earlier novels and a biography of Mrs. Fields of the Cookies, and you worked with Margaret Mead?
I went to Columbia General Studies while I was living in New York after college and driving a cab. She was a wonderful person. She was the smartest person I've ever known. She was very, very intent on living her own life. She got married before each field trip and divorced the guy afterwards because she had to. She couldn't go alone as a woman, so she did what she had to do. And she did ask me to be her protege, or one of them, and come work with her at the Museum of Natural History. I was incredibly flattered, and I thought about it for a long time before saying no, because I realized that if I became an anthropologist and worked with her, I would wind up sitting in a village somewhere in a thatched hut, writing down who called who aunt and who called who uncle, which is what anthropology is, in the field. And I didn't want to spend my life that way.
Had you wanted to be a writer at that point?
I was a writer since I was 11 years old. I started out writing little detective stories, little crime novels. And my mother, I had a good mom, my mother would type them up for me so I could see them in print on the page. I was always a writer. I was never not a writer. I wrote for my class newspaper in elementary school. Always a writer. I wrote for the newspaper when I was in high school. By the time I was in college, I was the editor of the literary magazine. Before I started writing novels, I was a poet for a long time. After I moved to Seattle, I did a lot of copywriting for advertising. I had this friend, and together we were like copywriting desperados. When these guys at agencies couldn't come up with an idea, they would call Norman and I. They paid us each $1,000 a day, which was a lot of money in the 70s. And that enabled me, number one, to survive. Number two, I learned a whole lot about writing from trying to write copy. That is not easy to do. You have to get a lot done in a few words, and it has to be strong. I have a lot of respect for the advertising industry. Do I like to watch ads on television? No, not especially. Although I have to say, from time to time, I am really impressed by the ability of the people who put those ads together.
Which came first, the novels or the biography of Mrs. Fields?
I wrote a piece for Esquire about the 200 people who would lead America into the millennium, into the 2000 period. And it was kind of funny, when my editor at Esquire called me, he said, "Would you be willing to take this piece?" I said, "Of course I'll take it. Why wouldn't I?" He said, "Well, a lot of the other writers want to be among the 200 who will or lead, you know, America into the millennium." I said, "No, not me. I don't think I'll be leading America anywhere." So I went out to Park City, Utah, and did a story about Randy and Debbie Fields. Debbie Fields was phenomenally successful doing Mrs. Fields cookies and very smart. She had a good thing. She made a huge amount of money. About 6 months, 8 months after I wrote the Esquire piece, I got a call from her saying she wanted to write an autobiography. After a little bit of negotiation, we negotiated a fee that was very high for me at the time compared to the money I'd gotten for novels. And that was the money on which I moved to Paris. And that was why I wrote the biography or autobiography of Debbie Fields.
But before then you'd written those four early novels.
Yes.
When you look at them now, do you see the embryonic Alan First that we all know now?
No, not in any way whatsoever. Those are garbage, those novels. They're trashy novels. I was 29 when I started doing that, okay? And it's too young. I believed that to write a novel, you did marketing. You aimed at a certain segment of the population, wrote a novel that you thought they'd like to read, were plenty funny, which those novels are, and you would be a bestseller. Well, I never came close to anything. I never approached mid-list. I was the guy supporting the mid-list. I was the guy on the bottom. When Your Day in the Barrel was published by Athenaeum, no less, I had a friend who was a book salesman in Seattle, and I called him one day, and I said, well, how's the book doing? He says, well, wait a minute, I have the numbers here. And he looked, and he looked, and he said, you're doing better than one other book. I said, really? What book am I doing better than? He says, it's a cookbook. I said, really? I said, what's it called? He said, First You Take a Leak. It didn't do well.
No. But at some point after those novels, Esquire hired you to do a trip to Eastern Europe.
That's
right?
Correct.
What changed? I mean, out of that came Night Soldiers, which is a very good book. What happened?
What happened was I had never seen a police state. I knew the words, but when you went to the Soviet Union in those days, it was right there to see. They weren't subtle about it, and they weren't kidding about it. And you saw how they operated, and it was terrifying. It was really scary. By the time I got back to the United States, my wife was interviewed at a certain point, and she said, I sent my husband to the USSR, and someone else came back. I now had what I will call moral purpose or something like that. I had heart's passion. I had something I hated. Fascism, tyranny, authoritarianism, call it whatever you like. And then, if you have that in your heart, you sit down at a typewriter or a computer, now you're going to have something. Not until.
And Night Soldiers, I think you mentioned, takes place in 34, is that?
It starts in 34, it goes all the way to 45, because I thought I wanted to write a single panoramic spy novel. And I never realized when I was writing Night Soldiers that I would write 12 more.
So you finished Night Soldiers, and it came out and did better than the other books.
A lot better, but not all that much better. It was not widely reviewed, but there were people who read it who realized that this was a real deal. My agent at the time said, you're not going to get rich on this, but your life and career are going to change. And she was absolutely right about that.
And so each book, you would go back to the same source. At what point did you go, you know, this is my thing? I mean, at a certain interview I did with you several years ago, you said the big secret is that on some level this is a series, even though the main characters are different.
That's correct. It's one big novel with so far 13 chapters and another one coming in 2 years.
And you also said that on some level your main character is the same person. I mean, he's different.
Yeah, he's always 40 years old. He's always a speculative kind of person. He's always an honorable person. He's always an amateur who gets caught up in the war, who feels, all of them, that they have to do something. There comes a point.
The book that caught my eye, and the first time I interviewed you, was Kingdom of Shadows. Was that a key change in Alan First, that you were now on tour and were going to reach the next level?
It's the first book I wrote that was a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. It also is a very significant book for me. I had written probably the weakest of all these 13 books, which was called Red Gold. It didn't do well. We had to rent our house in Sag Harbor for the summer. We got an apartment in New York on 11th Street. I sat down in that apartment, and it turned out to be a great place to write. Who knows why? It just was. And I thought, well, you know, I don't care anymore. I don't care. I now am going to write exactly what I want. Exactly what I want. And I wailed on it, and I went wider this way, deeper that way, higher the other way, and bang on the New York Times bestseller list. That was a lesson for me. I was looser. I was freer, as though having somewhat failed in the previous book, it no longer mattered what I did. So I could indulge myself in ways that I hadn't previously. And that turned out to be absolutely the right thing to do.
Do you still feel that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. More with every book. I think I've discovered something about the writing of fiction and the freedom of the heart, and that they have to be damn close.
Alan First, for a long time, your name would not appear on IMDb, but now it has. There was a series version, well, almost like a very long movie, of Spies of Warsaw with David Tennant. Did you have anything to do with that?
I knew who the screenplay writers were. I mean, I was paid for it by the BBC. And I told them, if you need help, call me. If you don't need help, don't call me. I was not going to be a pest. Oh, it's my book. It's my movie. Forget it. I could care less. It was in other people's hands. They did the best they could. It was an okay production. It wasn't that great. Some of it was wonderful. The cinematography was wonderful, all on location. The Polish and German actors who played in it were terrific theater-trained actors. It's a pleasure to watch them. David Tennant was a little wispy for a military attaché. He doesn't quite read as a military attaché, but he's a good actor, and he did a good job. I didn't think he did a bad job at all.
Yeah, the problem I have with Tennant, of course, is I look at Tennant and I still see the Doctor. But you know.
Right. I think a lot of other people did, too. But I'm glad that the movie was made. It had, I think, an excellent director, a woman named Koki Giedroyč, who's of Lithuanian descent and married to some kind of aristocrat in England. And she's a good director. And she will continue to be a good director. Look for her name someday.
The thing I liked about it was that it was a chance, and we don't get to see this too often, of taking a novel and actually putting the novel on screen without worrying too much about extending it like Game of Thrones or condensing it into a two-hour film. So you had a 4 or 5 hour film.
Yeah. They followed the story. I mean, and a lot of the scenes are very, very good.
I want to get back a little bit to creating atmosphere, which is a key element of all your books. I guess trying to find out how you do it is kind of – it's unconscious at this point, you think?
It is. It is. I'm only interested in details, details, details. What was in the room? What did the room look like? What did her voice sound like? What was she wearing? How did he negotiate the passage on the train, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you worry about anachronism?
I have a huge anachronism alarm. Lights, sirens, bells, whistles. I will not permit myself an anachronism. I'm incredibly sensitive to it. What could he have known at the time? Period, paragraph. They say Paris will be bombed. Well, that's what people thought. And I do not give people or allow people to have foreknowledge in any way whatsoever.
And you're, in a sense, spared worrying about English language cliches or slang because your characters don't speak English, or when they do speak English, you keep it very straightforward.
I keep it very straightforward, and I use the English of the period. If you look at movies in the 1930s, people spoke in a completely different way. You know, they said things like, "Now see here, Harrison," you know, or "Who do you take me for?" You know, that voice and that sentence is right from 1930s movies. Nobody says that anymore. Nobody talks like that anymore.
There's also Jewish characters who hide their Jewishness, making me think that was pretty common in Europe at the time.
I guess it was. I don't know of many Jewish characters that hide their Jewishness.
I'm talking about the guy from Officer Technica.
Max DeLion is half-Jewish, half-aristocratic Polish.
And the woman in Berlin.
she hides her Judaism. She's living in Berlin in 1938 and has a deal with the Gestapo. They know that she's Jewish, but she says it's not so good to be Jewish around here these days, and she goes to church and changes her first name. A lot of Jews did that.
There's also a whole bunch of different police and spy units from Germany. I mean, you can't tell one from the other. There's the Gestapo, the SS, and so on and so forth. It didn't really matter if somebody knocked on your door, though.
Well, it mattered to some degree. The villains in Mission to Paris is the von Ribbentrop Bureau, which basically came out of the foreign ministry. The people that they're fighting against here, they don't know who they are. As Max DeLion says, these people are opposing us. They're trying to destroy us. I don't know who they are. We'll never know who they are. And I leave it at that.
Because that's how it was.
That's how it was.
And a lot of people never learn what is really going on because they only see it from their own perspective.
That's correct. There's no way for them to find out. You know, Germany tried to keep what they were doing very secret. They really did. They knew they might lose the war, and they knew there would be a reckoning if they did, and that's exactly what happened. A lot of people were hanged at the end of the war and deserved it.
You also, in your books, have continuing characters. Actually, Wikipedia has a list of around 20 of them. Two of them appear in here. One is Count Polanyi, who has been in probably more books than any of the others, and another is a spy named S. Cole.
DeLion talks to him in search of Russian anti-aircraft ammunition. S. Kolb is extremely tart and funny. And then Polanyi's, you know, has several scenes because he becomes a client of Farrar's at the Coup d'Etat law office in Paris.
Which must have made you very happy. I'm just going to make Polanyi a client here.
Well, I wanted to bring Polanyi back because I had a sense that given the biochemistry of the book, he would do well within it because he is of the class that that law firm served. So, yes, there are some great scenes between Polanyi and Farrar.
When you take a character like Kolb or Polanyi and stick them in a book that takes place in a different time frame, do you go back to the other books and
I don't have time for that. They are independent. They can be two places at the same time. I'm not trying to pass an exam or anything. Just trust me, Polanyi showed up there no matter where he was in the last book. Don't worry about it.
Alan, first, I'll go back to something that you said a long time ago, is that if you took a dartboard of Europe and you went at the dartboard, you would probably land at a certain point in some kind of civil war.
True, right and left at each other's throats.
So it could be the Balkans, it could be Italy, it could be Spain, it could be Belgium, it doesn't matter where it is. It's not going to be England, but...
Well, England had a considerable fight with the Communist Party, with the dock workers in Liverpool and with the textile workers in Manchester and Birmingham. All was not perfect in the UK. The upper classes had their, you know, particular arrangements. And the dock workers in Liverpool didn't necessarily like working for nothing.
It could be anywhere.
Couldn't it?
One question I always ask is, I put a time frame on this. When you're writing any of these books, but in particular Midnight in Europe, what parallels, in this book in particular, do you see with what's going on today?
I don't ever spell that out. I don't put it in on purpose. But when I'm writing, at times, I feel this is echoic of what's going on today. But it's like I stumble into it and learn it from the writer inside myself. I don't sit there with a piece
right.
of paper and say, I'm going to do a character like XYZ, you know, the right-wing Tea Party guy. I don't do that. If people want to find parallels, they can find parallels. But I am not a teacher, and I do not do sermons. And I can't explain it. This is like, depending on how well you read history, you will see parallels.
Alan, first, what are you working on now?
Oh, I can't tell you. I'm working on a new book, but I am working on a new book and hoping to use some of the characters from this book in that book. I like some of the characters in this book really well.
Can you give us a time frame of the next book?
No, I'm not sure because I don't have the story yet. And all the stories have their own time frame that come with them. I don't get to pick. If I'm writing something about Czechoslovakia, the last chapter has to be about September 1938. There's no question about that. And so I back up 7-8 months and start the book there.
So at this point, you have the idea of the characters, but you're not quite sure. You haven't taken the dartboard and gone...
No, I don't know what exactly they're going to do or what the location is. I don't know. I don't ever say because I decide things, change my mind. Then I go, oh, I know I'll do this. And the next morning I go, oh, I don't want to do that. And I don't want to say something that turns out later not to be true.
So you're just taking notes at this point?
I'm just taking notes because I'm on tour, flying a lot. That's a very productive time for me. Why? I don't know. I'm in a lot of hotel rooms. I'm in a lot of airports. I have a lot of time like that. When I run out of the New York Times crossword puzzle, I start fiddling around with a new book.
You've been listening to an interview with Alan First, whose latest novel, which deals in its own way with the Spanish Civil War, is Midnight in Europe. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.